Coming from the lower eight in San Francisco, it's the Are You Serious Show.
Are you serious?
I'm Are You Serious, and this is my show. All right, yeah, we're back. I think this might be show number 15. Is that right? I tend to lose track. I hope you joined us last week. I think I sounded like a fucking zombie last week. Anyway, I hadn't gotten enough sleep, and I tried this quasi-legal smart drug, which makes me want to read and write, but it doesn't make me want to speak. So it was a little tough. And before we can have any fun today, I have to take care of a little bit of business. First of all, I did promise my friend Dan Sarodsky, the Orthodox anarchist, that I would mention that an excerpt from my book, Counterculture Through the Ages, From Abraham to Acid House with Dan Joy, is on his wonderful website, Jew School. Yes, yes, you heard me correctly, Jew School. .com, and you should go and check it out. And I've got all kinds of public stuff coming up soon, which I don't really, I'm just not in the mood to do it. Maybe like Diana, maybe you could wear a wig and go out.
I would love to be serious. Are You.
But I guess, I mean, the things I should mention at this particular show are Rant and Rave Forum in Mill Valley, and you can look that up at www.neofiles.net, and Webzine 2005, which should be a really cool all-weekend event, and that's at webzine.com. And I'll have links to that and to other upcoming
events.
Are
you doing a panel on that?
I'll be on a panel on podcasting, actually.
Terrific.
What they call podcasting. And I hope I'll be able to figure out what to say, since Jeff is the one who really knows what the hell we're doing here. And I'm just a mouthpiece. But anyway, it's great to see you both back here.
Thank you. Great to
Diana.
Be back here.
And Jeff, you're always welcome in your own house.
I'd love to hear that, man.
Welcome. Come right in. You can't afford to miss this.
Step right up.
So we're about to phone Ed Rosenthal, hero of the medical marijuana movement and the pro-pot movement in general. And as most of you probably know, all you Are You Serious Show potheads out there, Ed was busted back in 2002 while cultivating marijuana for medical purposes. He was licensed by the city of Oakland, and he was convicted by a jury of 12. Nine of them later disavowed that verdict when they found out that Rosenthal had in fact been licensed to grow. Testimony to that effect had not been allowed during the trial. Now Rosenthal is appealing his conviction. And so here we go.
Hello?
Hi, Ed. It's Are You Serious? And we're on the radio. How are you today?
Very good. And yourself?
I'm doing pretty well. Haven't had any marijuana yet today. I feel clear and ready to speak. So I guess the first question, and you were only sentenced to one day in prison, so why are you appealing?
The court gave me three felonies.
Right.
And I don't like being a felon, for one thing.
Okay.
But more importantly, my case may very well be significant, a significant, if the decision comes right, it could change the way marijuana laws are enforced. And the main thing that I'm appealing is the federal law that protects narcs from federal prosecution. And what I mean by that is that there's a law that says that if you're an agent of the city or state and you are carrying out drug policy of the city or state, that you can not be arrested by the federal government for carrying out that policy. And that's so that narcs can possess legally, can sell, can buy, can transport. And I was made an officer of the city of Oakland. So the government said that I would be able to, and the city government said that their policy was for me to distribute marijuana to medical patients, and that's what I was doing. So as an officer of the city, I should be free from prosecution, and that's what my appeal is based on.
Okay, and how do you see, if you win, how do you see that affecting the situation for medical marijuana broadly? I mean, will there be immediate response to this at the legal level?
There could be, because all the city would have to do would be to cities and states could deputize people to distribute marijuana, and it would be legal.
And what level of the court system are you appealing this at right now?
This is a Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. And then let's say I won and the federal government appealed it, it would go up to the Supreme Court.
Okay, are you hoping that might, well, obviously you're hoping you'll win, so you are looking forward to seeing this go to the Supreme Court.
Well, I suppose that if I won, the federal government would appeal it, and that doesn't mean that the Supreme Court would accept the case.
No, that's true.
Only accept about 3% of the cases that come to it.
Now, the DA in the case on the other side is dissatisfied with your sentence. This doesn't come up, and he'd like to do something about that. This doesn't come up in the same legal procedure as the one that you're having right now, does it? His desire
it
to... What?
It did, but yeah. Between the time that his appeal was filed and that my case came up, there was a decision by the U.S. Supreme Court. It's Booker, and it said that judges have a right to make decisions, and that the minimums are only advisory, they're not mandatory. And so it sort of made the prosecutor's argument moot. On the other hand, the prosecutor had lied to the grand jury in order to get my indictment, and the federal judge, Breyer, who tried the case, admitted that he had misled the grand jury. So that was another issue, because we feel that I should never have even been indicted because this federal agent lied to the grand jury.
So you're not
testifying either. So that's another grounds that we're appealing on.
So you're not just talking about the fact that they didn't allow you to present that you were growing as a licensed grower, but there was some other piece of fibbery that was going on before the grand jury?
That's right. Yeah. But it's not just, you see, I think that the court could decide, or the court could decide that based on a simple reading of the federal law, which is titled 885D, just a simple reading of that law would exonerate me so that I should not have even stood trial. Once it was established that I was an officer of the city, I was exempt from prosecution. And that's the main thing that I'm appealing on. It's not that the jury didn't get to hear it. It's that the law in itself was valid and the federal government didn't stand by that law.
Have you gotten any help from the city of Oakland on all this?
I did. The city attorney testified for me in pretrial hearings, but it would not let the federal government would not let the jury hear it.
Why?
For my testimony, because it would show that I was an officer of the city, and if the jury knew that once a jury found out that I was an officer of the city, they repudiated their conviction, which was the first time in American history that a jury has done that. 9 members of the jury stood up and said, we were duped, we were conned, we would not have convicted if we had known that he was an officer of the city carrying out his duties as an officer.
All right, we've got a very special guest with us in the studio today. Tim Kavanaugh is back after debating about conspiracy theory just a few weeks ago. And Kavanaugh was the last editor standing at the Notorious Suck website, and he currently edits the online version of the popular libertarian magazine Reason. And welcome back, Tim.
Thanks. Good to be back. It feels like just a mere 2 weeks.
Feels like home. You're in an intimate studio with a picture of Richard Nixon bowling directly behind your
head. That's when I knew I had come home.
Knocking down some pins in the interest of the state, no doubt.
Demonstrating the domino theory.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Yeah, the pin theory, the pinhead theory. So let's start off by talking about scope. And would you agree that the scope was like the essence of snarkiness? Would you describe it in
scope?
Scope? Did I say scope?
Yes.
Wow, you said it twice, man.
Like, I must have been thinking about getting it.
Because you got to go. You got to go with Listerine. I
feel like. Yeah, definitely.
The actual germ
I've
fighting.
I've lost control over my show.
We need an intervention. Are you required?
So what do you think? Was suck snarky? People like to talk about snarkiness these days.
Yeah, no, it was the essence of snarkiness before snark was really a term of disapprobation. I know the Believer, the sort of with this magazine that's in the Dave Eggers orbit.
Exactly.
They instituted a snark watch for a while where they would
snark allowed.
Yeah, and it was they'd have a thing where they'd find critics who were really rough on a movie or a book or something, and say that's just snark. And so we were that. That was.
What do you think about the anti-snark reaction?
You know, it's a sign of a weakness in America, I think. You know, we don't
know. A sign of
decadence. We're a nation that wants to go to war with everybody under the sun, but, you know, we haven't even got that. You can't even tolerate a little tough talk.
I think what snark is it's like the quip that the target of your quip might not get.
Yeah.
Is that right? So it's a little elitist. There's a little elitism.
Yeah, a little bit. And, you know, I mean, there can be a little bit of, sort of like a Bill Murray thing where you're just, deadpanning when there's actually nothing behind your deadpan. There's not really any kind of interesting critique. I think we mixed it up pretty well between actually having, I don't want to say any point, but, just bringing up some interesting commentary about things.
There were the occasional pointless pieces every few days.
I think it was a conscious effort not to make a point. I think, that if you would get too serious on politics or something generally it was a fairly young writing staff, and they, like mid-20s to early 30s type of writing staff. So you tended to get, maybe the politics were not all that interesting. So it was more interesting, I think, to be undercutting your own argument in the interest of a joke.
Right.
Basically.
So people could toy around. It's hard to go for a while without making a point, although we do it very well here on the Are You Serious?
This is a really far afield, but one of the guys behind The Onion, one of the founders, God, I forget what his name was, used to do a comic called Jim's Journal, long before The Onion. This was like early 90s. He had a comic. Do you remember this comic?
No, I don't think I ever saw it.
It was just stick figures. And it was, a guy's journal who works at, like, a Kinko's or something like that. And every day it was a story that had really no point. It was like, a guy came in and I made a copy. He handed me, a $10 bill. I asked him if he had something smaller. And he said, yeah, no problem. And that will be the whole thing. And, you realize reading it for a while. It was in my college paper, and people totally hated the thing. It was like they would get letters every day. This is the stupidest thing. But if you read it on a regular basis, you realize it's really tough not to. The three-frame cartoon strip is just so lends itself to a punchline that not to do it is really tough to do on every day.
And these weren't just sort of surrealists. I mean, these were actual narratives, but with nothing.
Right, with nothing happening.
Really, nothing happening. That's pretty cool. It's interesting that you brought up The Onion because for people out there listening who may be of the younger generations and might not be familiar with Suck, I mean, Suck was a big deal on the net at that time in much the way that The Onion is a big deal to people now. You guys,
and was a big deal then too. I mean,
yeah, the Onion
really,
was also very vital at that time. So, how was Superstardom? No, I think Joey and Carl were really the
Joey and Carl were the superstars, and obviously Anna Marie Cox has gone on to fame
I'm
and fortune.
So sick of seeing her everywhere.
You know, that's
she's funny. She's pretty funny. But are you friends with Anna Marie?
Sure.
Can I touch her hem?
I don't know. I think she'll feel too much power go out of her if that happens.
Yeah.
But Heather Havrileski, too, writes some good TV stuff for Salon these days.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, whether any of us are working at the same level we were at SUC is probably, there are probably plenty of people out there who will say, no, we're not.
Right. But and you were the last editor on board. Do you feel captain of a sinking ship? Did you have Captain Queeg,
especially the last, the last couple of months, it was just me and me
throwing
and my
people
marbles.
Overboard.
Yeah. the one good thing about really going under is that you're freed of all responsibilities, so that and at the end I was like writing most of them and stuff like that, and it was kind of it was gone crazy. There was a big story, a big history of SUC a couple of weeks ago.
I saw that. That was really nice.
I haven't been able to bring myself to read.
Really?
Because that guy was an incredible reporter. He talked to every person, not everybody, but he really talked to a large number of people on the staff and really got a lot about the story. And, it was the kind of thing, if somebody's doing a story on SUC, I'm surprised when they're talking to me. But they were, was talking to a bunch of, contributors and all sorts of people. And was really thorough and knew what he was talking about and could talk to me for probably 45 minutes. I was not on my game when I talked to him. I should have, spent some more time thinking about it before talking to him because I didn't really have a lot of good answers for him.
Right.
And for that reason, I haven't been able to read the article. Although Nick Gillespie tells me I come off as the Fitzcarraldo of SUC, which, I'll take as a compliment.
Ooh, yeah. an opera upriver in the jungle
just
with Joey and Carl
suck over the hill for no
sounds
purpose.
Like a very frightening thing. And now you're with the libertarian magazine Reason. So who knew, man?
Yeah. Well, we had a lot of cross pollination. Brian Doherty, who's a Reason staffer, was a regular SUC contributor. We've gotten a lot of the former SUC people to write at least occasionally for Reason. Nick was a regular contributor. Nick Gillespie is the editor of Reason. And so I was, unemployed for a while after SUC went down, but I finally ended up at Reason. And,
didn't SUC sort of start out making fun of the libertarianism of Wired? I mean,
Joey
and Carl's trip was...
They were... Well, yeah, it was making fun of the sort of messianic quality of Wired, which... the interesting thing is that in a lot of ways, that's what is the most interesting thing about Wired when it's all said and done. I mean, you go back and look at any issue from 1991 or 92, I guess was the first issue,
right,
to 96, it's not like any of the predictions really came true. It's not that, you could go through and find just things where they were spectacularly wrong.
Yeah.
But they were
yeah.
spectacularly wrong. That's the important thing. It was really an interesting thing where every week there was a manifesto and all that kind
of
stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I used to kind of ridicule Louis Rossetto a lot, but after he was gone and they sort of brought in these sort of people who were just journalists, they were just sort of guns for hire, it lost a certain authenticity.
Well,
they got some of it back now with Chris Anderson, who's into this stuff.
Yeah, well, one of those people made me a very generous job offer at one point, and I said no to stay at SUC. I'm not in the position to throw stones at anybody.
All right. We should break for a moment to hear some music, and we'll be right back.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Bussing. This is for the streets. The streets everywhere. Streets affected by the storm called America. I'm doing this for y'all. And for me, for the creator. Crossing these streets. $1 per a human being. Feel like Katrina clap. See that Katrina clap. Listen, homie, it's Dollar Day in New Orleans. It's for the water, everywhere, and people dead in the street. It eats. And Mr. President, he bout that cash. He got a policy for handling the niggas in trash. And if you poor, you black. I laugh, they won't give you ass. you better off on crack. Dead or in jail with a gun and Iraq. And it's as simple as that. No opinion, my man, it's mathematical fact. Listen, a million poor since 2004, and they got aliens and killians to waste on a war. And make you question what the taxes is for, or the cost to reinforce the broke levy war. Tell the boss he shouldn't be the boss anymore. Yahweh, I mean, God save these streets. $1 per every human being. Feel like Katrina clap. See that Katrina clap. Ha. God save these streets. Quit being cheap, nigga. Freedom ain't free. Feel like Katrina clap. Blah. See that Katrina clap. Lord have mercy. Lord God, God save our soul. Oh God save our soul. Oh God, oh God save our soul. Lord God, God save our soul. Oh God save our soul. Soul, soul, soul survivor. It's dollar day in New Orleans. It's water, water, hey, when babies dead in the street. It's enough to make you holler out like where the fuck is Sir Bono and his famous friends now. Don't get it twisted, man, I dig you too. But if you ain't about the ghetto, then fuck you too. Who care about rock and roll when babies can't eat food? Listen, homie, man, this shit ain't cool. It's like dollar day for New Orleans. It's water, water everywhere. Homies dead in the streets. And Mr. President's a natural ass. He out treating niggas worse than they treat the trash. God save these streets. A $1 per a human being. Feel like Katrina clap. See that Katrina clap. God save these streets. Quit being cheap, nigga. Freedom ain't free. Feel like Katrina clap. See that Katrina clap. Soul survivor. God, God, God save our soul. Oh God save our soul. Oh God, oh God save our soul. Lord God, oh God save our soul. Oh God save our soul. Oh God, oh God save us. God and God and paying and for the wicked to rule the world. Say God and God and paying and for the wicked to rule the world. God and God and paying and for the wicked to rule the world. And even when they do, it's a matter of truth before they wicked ruling is through. So God save these streets. A dollar day from New Orleans. God save these streets. Quit being cheap, homie, freedom ain't free. God save these streets. A $1 per a human being. Feel like a cheetah clip. See that a cheetah clip. God save these streets. Quit being cheap, nigga. Freedom ain't free. Feel like Katrina clap. Get up, Katrina clap. Soul survivor. Lord God, God save our soul. God save our soul. Feel like Katrina clap. Let's make them dollars stack. Hurry, belly streets. God save these streets. God save these streets. God save the soul. Feel like Katrina clap. See that Katrina clap. Soul survivor. Don't talk about it, be about it. Peace.
Are you serious? So I interviewed your boss, Nick Gillespie, for Neophiles, the text version of Neophiles, a while back, and I bugged him about the word reason, actually. Yeah. And so let me bug you also about the word reason, because I've been thinking about it a lot, particularly over the last couple of weeks. And, like, if I expect, like, things to in the world to make sense, and if I expect people to be reasonable, it causes me a lot of stress and distress. And if I decide kind of several points in the day, you know what, people aren't going to be reasonable, nothing's going to make sense, you know, I'm unreasonable as well, then it's very relaxing. So yeah. Do you have any thoughts on perhaps giving up on
reason?
At least in your personal life, you know,
abandon any in my personal life, I don't think it's ever been a part of my personal life. But
that's honest.
That's a legitimate question. How much is going to yield to, you know, a scientific approach to everything? And you know, reason, the word itself sort of has a lot of meaning in the libertarian universe with regard to, like, Ayn Rand and so forth.
Sure.
And it's true, you know, in some ways, you know, those may be spots that we don't cover so well. I think we tend to, among our readers too, and when we get commentary from our readers, except very occasionally, you get really this sort of dogmatic atheism among people whenever you talk about any sort of religious topic, which obviously everybody sort of has to talk about in the political climate today.
Sure.
And, you know, okay, that's fine. Religion doesn't make any sense. There's no such thing as God. It's all something everybody made up and yada, yada. But where do we go from there?
Well, personally, I think anybody who isn't agnostic is an idiot, because if you think you know, then you're an idiot. I'm a great respecter of not knowing, not being certain.
Right. And, you know, I mean, you have to accept that that's the way the most people on this planet believe in something, right? They have some sort of religious background, so you have to, you know, you can't. If you shut them out of the conversation, fine. It's going to be a small conversation.
So, I mean, would you say that the libertarians, on the whole, are like more cranky than your average American, or less cranky?
Wouldn't you be if not one of your ideas had ever been put in practice?
Are they less cranky than like left wing conspiracy theorists? Or,
no, probably not. Although I think there's probably more of a support network for left wing conspiracy theorists. You know, I don't know. You know, in a lot of ways, you know, we're in a libertarian moment right now. You know,
yeah,
we have
definitely
a lot of people who are, you know, everybody to some extent defines themselves. Oh, yeah, I'm a libertarian, but, you know, of course the government shouldn't be allowing people to say what they think or something like that.
Well,
you know, you always get these sort of kind of.
I mean, the comprehension of the idea of free speech itself, you know, the idea that somebody should say something that you think is completely horrible and repulsive, it's very hard. It's very counterintuitive, really.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Most people.
I was watching John Roberts in his confirmation hearings and really found myself agreeing for the first time with Senator Sam Brownback. You know, he went off in this long tear about how, you know, the Supreme Court ruled in favor of virtual child pornographers, and you know, I thought that was what the gist of where he was going. And then he sort of reversed course and said, but at the same time, the McCain-Feingold reform, you know, campaign finance reform passed. How can you say that this one is protected and that, you know, the right of people to say what they want about politics during a political campaign is not protected free speech? And it was pretty, you know, I have to admit he was right about that. Go ahead.
Yeah, let's go we're heading into serious politics.
Sure.
And you were saying the libertarian view is gaining some points. I thought the libertarian view actually gained some points recently as a result of a couple of Supreme Court decisions, and I may take them one at a time.
Sure.
Medical marijuana.
Yeah.
Okay, so the medical marijuana advocates went after their right to do medical marijuana in California on a state's rights basis. And the people who ruled in their favor, who were in a minority, were all right-wing conservative
Right.
judges, you know, on ruling in this way on a libertarian basis, which sort of blew my mind, because if somebody says, well, why do you bother to vote for the Democrat against the Republican in a presidential election, my answer would usually be the Supreme Court.
Right.
Yeah. And so here's a new twist.
Well, let me, you know, and if actually the ones who, the four, they were Rehnquist, O'Connor, Thomas, and I guess Kennedy. In the Raich decision, they were the minority. I could be wrong on Kennedy, but not only are they the you know, four of the conservatives, but they were all appointed by conservative presidents, I believe.
Sure.
I think all of them have, you know, because they're these sort of oddballs in the Supreme Court who will get appointed by a liberal and turn out to be a conservative. That's a great argument.
I mean,
right,
think you guys took advantage of that, or like picked up notice? I mean, do hippies notice that,
you know,
that the right wing judges?
I don't know. You know, I saw certainly a little bit less that one than in the Kelo decision, which I'm assuming you're also getting, the New London eminent domain decision.
I was just that was the second one I was going to
bring
up.
Yeah, that you definitely saw a lot of liberals going, because liberals are not necessarily anti-drug, right? I mean, that's, you know, this the idea. Certainly you can't say the Democratic Party has ever distinguished itself for its
position on the drug war.
I guess I said anti-drug. I meant anti-drug war.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Pro-dope.
Pro-dope is the, yeah, that's the position. You know, we need to come out. You know, if you, Jacob Sullum, our you know, regular Friday columnist, he has a book out called Saying Yes. And it was... you know, it's an argument you're going to have a hard time. Everybody's going to gang up on you for making the argument, but it's an argument that's worth making. It's a saying, like, you know, you can't really talk about the drug war if you're only going to talk about it in technical terms. You have to say a lot of people use drugs recreationally without destroying their lives.
Right.
You
so
know what, though?
They
you
use
know what?
Well.
Just using the Comedy Central as an index, there seems to be a lot more support for the, you know, I smoke weed and I like it and it doesn't ruin my life, sort of like the Bill Hicks, you know, line on that. And so, I mean, you know, that's a Comedy Central is on basic cable. And basically, I mean, you know, I guess celebrities are less concerned about coming out and admitting that they smoke pot all the time and they like it. But, you know.
The problem is, does that come out of, you know, and in some ways, you know, nobody really has a coherent philosophical view or a coherent view of the world. We make up our view of the world based on, you know, what's working for us.
On what we smoke.
So, yeah, I mean, you could say, yeah, I'm pro-pot, but are you willing to, you know, accept all of the ideas about personal responsibility and about personal freedom and choice that go along with that? Most people are not. But they are pro-pot, so, you know, we pick up our allies where we can.
Right. Well, I mean, things, you know, life is full of nuances, I would say. So, I mean, it's just, you did start to go into the other Supreme Court decision I was going to ask you about, eminent domain. And, I mean, here we had a situation where, for a long time, I kind of figured, well, eminent domain was about the government wants to do something really useful, like, you know, put through an important road or build a hospital, and there's, like, one lone redneck, you know, stubborn guy who stands in the way, an old coot, and they finally have to push him out of the way. And it turns out what they're doing is, like, moving poor people out of their homes so they can put up shopping centers.
Yeah.
So naturally, I mean, this is red meat for liberals because, you know, corporate entities are going to move into shopping malls, and it's being supported by the state. So yeah, it's a great kind of unifying.
Well, given that, you know, you have Clarence Thomas talking about how, you know, poor and minority people are going to suffer the most from this. And, you know, I said that there was a lot of outrage from liberals on this. And it's true, there was some. But given what a surprising take that was by, you know, to hear from that wing of the Supreme Court really, you know, expressing its concern about how is this going to affect the poor. You know, it really what's surprising is the silence of the liberals, of so many, you know, the New York Times, for example, as we all know, and I guess the American Prospect, you know, was defended that decision and that kind of thing.
It's, yeah, I mean, I think the liberal community has been sort of split, kind of pretty much 50-50. But I think probably more the mainstream liberals are in favor of it. And people who are a little outside the system are critical of that decision.
Yeah, absolutely. You certainly see more of, I don't know how the various liberal bloggers went down, but I think you'll see more outrage in that milieu than you will, you know, at the New York Times, certainly.
The one other, I mean, the big thing, obviously, on people's minds lately is Hurricane Katrina. And I've been reading a bit on the Reason blog about how people are dealing with that. And to me, this plays against laissez-faire. Certainly as a spirit, if not necessarily as something that's done in practice, because we really don't have laissez-faire. What we have is actually a massive state. But in general, the idea that people, can fend for themselves and, you know, they just, business that can take care of things and that we don't need social programs to help people, I think takes a hit. On the other hand, the massive failure. So, I mean, there's two sides to that. But what are your thoughts?
Yeah, it's my feeling, because I'm basically a pessimist, I guess, is that this is going to be a big win for, you know, big government thinking, and that you know, so-called progressives are really going to seize this as, you know, evidence that this is what we need, is the government to take a more active role, and you know, it is. It's kind of hard to make the argument that, you know, just for-profit businesses, if they have been handling everything in there, from the levees to the buses, you can make that argument. If you said that Greyhound would not have left 500 buses to get swamped.
Right. Well, in fact, they were willing to come in, and they were stopped.
Yeah.
I mean, in combination with NGOs and with people, you know, working among themselves,
right.
You know.
And certainly, you know, if local, you might be able to make a more of a local government argument, right? That if people in the area had been fully responsible for upholding that levy and it hadn't been money coming from Washington, everybody sits around and waits till Washington makes its decision, they would make damn sure that levy was going to work, right?
Yeah,
they
would. But in terms of the broad idea that class and race are still issues and still a problem, I think it plays more towards government programs to help people.
We're at the end of, you know, many decades of government programs that were not supposed to stop things like this from happening, and they continue
right, but
to
were
happen.
they were cut back.
Yeah,
starting with the Reaganism. Anyway, I think I'm afraid we're running out of time. We want to thank Tim Kavanaugh for coming in, and do not fear, because Tim Kavanaugh will be back really soon. In fact, to him, it will feel like just a few minutes, and to you, it may feel like about a month or so.
The Learning Annex is offering an event called An Evening with Amber Fry. Yeah, that's right. Scott Peterson's fuck buddy is coming for an entire evening. No, it's not a one-on-one thing with a happy ending. Think about it. An evening is a hell of a lot of time to fill. Is Amber Fry already a headliner? But here's the twist. An evening with Amber Fry is touted as a self-help seminar called How to Change Stumbling Blocks into Stepping Stones with Amber Fry. One problem. Every time I see Amber Fry on TV, she never really has anything insightful to say, not to mention always looks peeing her pants uncomfortable. Don't get me wrong, I'm all for cashing in on minor fame. After all, Amber Fry is the William Hung of women who bone guys who killed their wives. So hell yes, I'll pay $20 for An Evening with Amber Fry. Sign me up. I'm wearing a tie to impress Amber, my Amber. Who knows? She's single, I'm single. She's got small town values, but most of all, everyone knows she puts out on the first date. Has An Evening with Amber Fry started yet? I asked the woman checking off names outside a hotel conference room. It's just about to, she replies. Making a dreamy face, I add, I'd kill to go out with her. Inside what I expect to be a large hall moderated by Inside the Actors Studio's James Lipton is instead 12 people facing a single lectern. They consist of an old woman showing her friend pictures of a dog wearing a sweater, some desperate housewives, and a few scattered lone men who look like they solve crimes in their spare time and post the results on their websites. I just want to see her, says Ethel, sitting next to me, who gives off a smell old people have. She's seen Amber Fry on TV, thus the reason she wants to see her in person. Ethel gives a long, confused look, looking at the self-help seminar's bullet point sheet. Wait, this isn't about her life. It's about emotions and how to handle things. With a sour look, she reads the evening's agenda. Have a positive attitude. Is she teaching a course? I thought she's gonna be talking about her life. With a smattering applause, out comes the woman of the evening, Amber Fry, looking like, well, Amber Fry. Amber, my Amber, I exclaim, poking the old lady Ethel in the ribs next to me, remarks, she's taller than I thought. Yes, I like 'em tall. How will Amber Fry open an evening with Amber Fry? How will she break the ice? A show tune with sequence gowns with two hunky bodybuilders lifting her over her head? Fire, maybe? Instead, there's the awkward, I see a lot more guys in the audience than in San Diego. Dead silence followed by clumsy shuffling of notes. Then, life is a series of stepping stones followed by a series of stumbling blocks. I've learned one thing. Public speaking is not Amber Fry's forte. When the media came forward, I wondered why there was so much negativity about me. Amber, my Amber, looks as scared as any given animal that happens to be caught in headlights. Perhaps she, herself, needs the Learning Annex seminar, How to Be a Toastmaster. With mild confusion, the 12 of us read, maintain a positive attitude from the bullet point sheet. There's things during my trial that were out of my control. At times, there's things in our lives that are out of control. Her advice, remain positive. Amber, my Amber, concludes wittingly with, in the end, it all comes down to choices to turn stumbling blocks into stepping stones. I feel bad for everyone involved with this event. It sure ended early, remarks Ethel, who smells like old people. She's a bit grumpy, but if she ever criticizes Amber, my Amber, again, I'll have no choice but to dump her body in the Berkeley Marina on my next Christmas Eve fishing trip. At least someone learned something from this workshop.
Many thanks go to Tim Cavanaugh, Ed Rosenthal, and the infiltrator Harmon.